Backseat Producers, episode 157, Nolan versus Snyder. This is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is David.
And we are the Backseat Producers.
And tonight's topic is slightly different from our standard program. We're going to talk As we are going to talk about directors.
We decided we're done with movies.
We're tired of it.
Yeah.
We did music last week. Next, we're moving on to plays.
I saw The Crucible last weekend.
How was it?
I didn't actually see it. Okay. I've seen it done before, and when I saw it done before, it was excellent. Good. I also saw The Lottery, but I was in that one, and it was also excellent.
Who were you in The Lottery?
I was just the guy calling the names.
Oh, okay.
It was, the lines were pretty easy.
Yeah.
Since I had a clipboard, I just wrote them down.
It does make it a little easier.
Yes.
All right, so no, this week's topic we're going to talk about, specifically, we're going to start with Christopher Nolan and Zack Snyder. But we may branch off into some
We will branch off into some of those.
Let's just say, for sure, we're going to be spoiling...
At least...
Everything they've ever done.
At least Batman Begins...
Dark Knight.
Inception.
Watchmen.
And Inception.
At least those.
Because we spoiled that a couple of weeks ago.
Well, Inception is kind of the one that breaks the mold.
Yeah.
For my argument here.
Right.
So... I'll probably spoil
it. But I do have a new idea about Inception, because that was a topic we had before. We had kind of an argument about what exactly
happened at the end.
I'm going to go ahead and jump into it right now.
just not even waiting till the topic starts to derail it.
Yes,
Tony. Don't think I won't see what you're doing over here.
So, all right. So the rules they established were. If someone dies,
yes,
in a dream,
depending on how deep they were,
they can go even deeper,
right? Or they wake up.
All right. So he only saw his wife in the dreams after she died in real life.
Okay,
which would have forced her farther into the dreams. So, therefore, potentially, what he was seeing when he was in dream space wasn't his manifestation of her, but really her. Because she was forced farther into dream space. So, that would have made it possible for this whole thing to be her dream and not his.
Yes, I agree with that. However, they would have to be together... in whatever was the real world.
And they would have to be together asleep.
Yes.
Yes.
Because that's the only way to get into somebody else's dreams. You have
right.
to be physically hooked up to them with
initially
them.
They were together asleep.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So that was just that. Another idea. It was something that came to me.
We're ready to get to the real topic,
yeah,
Tony?
Let's go. Let's do this.
So, we were talking last time, or the time before, about the differences in ideologies between Christopher Nolan and Zack Snyder. So, and the movies I'm going to toss as evidence here are Dark Knight, Batman Begins, Watchmen, and 300. Now, it seems to me that the difference in style of production is that Zack Snyder will make a movie that is absolutely empirically... to the source of the source material that he's making it from. Except that he makes it so much to the source material that it excludes and shuts out any sort of audience who doesn't already have a familiarity or a passion for the source material. Watchmen is an excellent example of
yes.
this.
I think Watchmen War is an exception because you can enjoy 300 without having read the original 300 comic.
You can. My only counter-argument to that is that I think that whether or not you can enjoy it is secondary to the fact that he tried to make it so much like the comic that even in places where it starts to drag and lose people who aren't familiar with it already, that's intentional.
Yeah, I think one thing to say about Zack Snyder is he really does have a knack and a talent for adapting source material very literally.
Yes.
And you know, regardless of what you think about the movies, his literal adaptation of the source material to film, it's spot on. I mean, he makes some changes. He does make a couple of changes for film. Not much, but there are a couple. But it also it draws the question: why weren't some more changes made? Why did he make all the choices that he made when there could have been other things he could have changed, or things that he could have kept the same? For example, I mean the big one in Watchmen is the ending. He changed the squid to the energy, and through that changed pieces of the story throughout.
Mm. And what I loved about that was that it was no easier to access for the audience. It made more sense. It was probably a better ending for the work just in general. Like, I thought that ending made it more poignant of a story.
Well, that was, again, intentional. I mean,
it was
Watchmen.
Easier to swallow.
Well, yeah, 20-year time difference between the time the Watchmen graphic novel came out and the time the Watchmen the movie. I mean, attitudes and politics have changed a whole heck of a lot since then.
But it was still supposed to be set in 1985, either way, which I was cool with. I was glad that they didn't update the time.
Oh, man, I was so glad they did not update the timeline. This is about oil. And terrorism.
It would have been horrible if they would have updated the timeline, just because it would have thrown everything else off.
Yeah, it would have been stupid, and Nixon wouldn't have made sense. And if you don't have Nixon in the story, I don't want it. But I can understand, and while I think that Watchmen is the second greatest movie that's ever been made, don't worry, Scott Pilgrim is number three. While I can recognize that it is the second greatest movie that's ever been made, I'm not hard-pressed to admit that it is difficult for audiences to get into.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they are familiar with the work itself, and they already know what the story is. I mean, because so many people saw the movie, and then... I thought it was going to be a superhero movie. Oh.
The thing was, so many people did not see the movie.
Yeah.
Let's correct that statement right there. Because they're really... At least in theaters, the movie failed. The movie failed at the box office.
Yes.
It did not make bank.
No.
And that's worth noting, too, because it was difficult to market. I think that was a part of the problem.
You're right. It was incredibly difficult to market because he didn't change what it was.
Well, he didn't change what it was.
And what it was is so
and
awkward.
It's deconstructionist comic book.
Yes.
You know, you're talking... Something that
it's not a comic book movie. It's a commentary on comic books and comic book movies. Well not so much
not
movies,
even comic book movies, but comic books. And to do that, you're talking about basically a subgenre of action films, is what most comic book movies are. Mm-hmm. They're not even a genre to themselves in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. You have exceptions to them, movies that have done very, very well at the box office. But they're off a very popular licensed product.
Not only are they off very popular licensed products, but I submit that Iron Man sold out. It's not comic booky enough. It plays to the mainstream audience.
Yeah. It plays more to the action.
It's an action
sci-fi.
Yeah.
But you know what? So was the comic book.
I mean, so was the comic book, but they changed some things from the comic book that make Tony Stark less appealing. Like, Robert Downey Jr. is a pretty boy. Tony Stark is a goddamn alcoholic,
but he's also a playboy too.
And they've been
self-destructive.
He didn't start that way.
That way,
he did not start that.
That
way.
Is only the later interpretations of Demon in a Bottle.
Yeah, and that was after 100 plus episodes or issues. That was 9 to 10 years into the run?
Dude, come on. It's all, when you're coming into it at the end, it's all the same thing.
What?
So if you have a 10-year run of something, but then in year 12 you come into it, all of it's coming out at the same time. You don't have to wait for it, is what I'm getting at. You don't have to do the journey, because the journey's already been done.
Yeah, but Spider-Man had a 30-year run. You still had to come in at the beginning.
Oh.
You still have to come in at the beginning.
Why? They reset character. It all the time.
Well, now they do.
30 years is a long goddamn time. So, and what the hell are we talking about now?
Snyder.
Right.
Well, let's throw also, though, in Snyder's style of movie making. And to be fair, the man's only made, what, 4 movies, major motion picture-wise.
Yeah, he's got...
His filmography is kind of short so
Watchmen
far.
300, Dawn of the Dead.
The Dawn of the Dead remake.
The Dawn of the Dead remake, which I thought was pretty good.
I haven't seen it. I can't speak to it at all. I've heard good things about it.
It wasn't bad.
From fans of the genre, I've heard good things, but I've not
had,
seen it.
It had Ving Rhames in it. You can't go wrong with it.
Ving Rhames is pretty cool, yeah.
The one Sucker Punch with... Oh,
Sucker Punch is upcoming.
That's not out yet. And Owls of the Guardians.
Yeah, the Owls of Cahootie. That's coming out in about 2 weeks.
That's another licensed property.
I'm anxious to see how he's going to handle that.
Have you seen the trailers for
Yes, they're beautiful.
They're gorgeous. They're absolutely beautiful.
But that's, again, one thing I noticed about his filmmaking style. It's very, very, very visual. Which, again, when you look back in his biography a little bit, this guy started out making commercials. That's where he cut his filmmaking teeth, is in the commercial world. And a lot of common critics seem to always put him down. He's more style over substance.
Didn't he also do some music videos? Or
yes, he was also did a bunch of MTV music videos too.
Yeah.
So again, that's where you get where his style comes in. A lot of the fast cut, slow mo action sequences and whatnot. He tends to use that a heck of a lot. But again, that's becoming one of his signature style elements.
Oh, yeah, he speeds up and slows down action for effect. He did it a lot in 300.
Well, yeah, that's where he became
the
popped out.
Long slow jump, and the moment of action is sped up to like triple speed.
Yeah, god damn, that whole sequence with Leonidas is just spearing people and hitting them with the shield.
Yeah, but you got to admit, it's visually very striking.
It's very striking.
It's beautiful.
And it's really cool to see a big action sequence like that, because it allows you to focus in on some of the little things that an action sequence like they did in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, well, actually,
like, Saving Private Ryan. It's they shoot it all at one pace, so you're constantly looking.
Well, yeah, it's very, very, very visually busy. And it's really, unless you're watching it almost riveted, like,
well,
you're going to miss.
It is very comic book. It really is.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the whole point of the shots is that he's not trying to overwhelm you with information. He wants you to see the blow.
Yeah.
He wants you to concentrate on the physical
focus your attention.
Mm-hmm. Not the chaos or whatever of battle, like Lord of the Rings or Saving Private Ryan.
Those are trying to show a completely different aspect of battle.
Yeah.
Where
epic.
It's intended to disorient you.
Right.
Well, Snyder doesn't want to disorient you. He slows everything down.
Let me show you just how badass this moment is.
Look at the spear go into that guy.
Yeah.
Right there.
But that's, again, I'll mention that when people get into tough situations like that, they say time slows down for them. Mm-hmm. He's trying to give you an element of that feel, what they're seeing.
I am Gerard Butler, and I am penetrating another man.
Yes. Zoom in on my nipple while I penetrate this man.
Whereas, let's take our other director. He comes from the art world.
Yes.
He started out as an English major, moving into the fine arts world of painting, and kind of doing the Steven Spielberg for his filmmaking filmmaking career by starting out with making little short 8mm films with his toys.
Yes. Yeah, and
I am actually looking these guys up, not just playing around on my phone.
It's fine.
So you've
got... He looks like an old Leonardo DiCaprio. Look at that.
He does.
So he's coming into it from a whole different angle of filmmaking, kind of from the grassroots fine arts side of it, whereas Zach comes in from the more or less commercial world, mm-hmm. where you don't have a lot of time to tell a story, so you tend to compress a lot of the action going on.
Well, everything that he's done has been more about the story,
right,
and not the Flash.
Right.
Which is ironic because he did the Prestige.
Now, the really fun thing is, also, Zach...
Seen all that yet.
Zach has always has just been a director, where Nolan has been a writer director of his own stuff,
right?
And he's had total control from the he totally controls the story.
Even Memento wasn't about the style, like the click there was the way that the story was told,
right?
Not necessarily any weirdness they did with the camera,
right?
There was no flash.
Right. It was
all
correct.
Pure,
yeah, the gimmick of that was not the Flash and the substance or the style. It was
the way it was told,
the novel way of storytelling.
I don't know if I would consider the Memento to be something that pushes mainstream audiences away, though, because it's a difficult movie to watch.
It is a difficult movie to watch, but the movie is kind of boring if you watch it straightforward.
The movie is boring if you watch it straightforward. I mean, it's...
There's no story.
Yeah.
There's really no story to it because you know right from the beginning that it's a setup.
Yeah. So, but when I went to go see it, I saw it with my buddy and he didn't get it. So he's kind of like my target audience. Mm. Like my target average audience. I don't understand what happened. Okay. So, I don't know if that movie pushes people away, though.
It's one of those movies that, depending on the moviegoer, You either have people that are like, I didn't get it, and leave it at that. Or you have people that are, I didn't get it, but I think I do, and now I want to go see it again to make sure I got it. In which case, you've created a secondary market all of a sudden that people are leaving the theater and going right back in.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Ordering the DVD so they can individually step through the scenes.
It's the same thing that happened with The Sixth Sense. Where people got to the ending and they got the twist, you know, he's really a ghost. Oh my god! And now you have to go back through.
So we can crap all over it.
Well, you go back through and see. Okay, what were the hints that he was dropping all over the place? But you failed to see the first time around,
or to see? No, wait, I didn't see that. There's no way that could have happened. I know that they talked. I know that there was a scene where he talked.
Eli yet?
What's that? Not yet.
All right.
I just haven't had a chance to see it yet.
Yeah.
Should we put that on the list?
Yeah, put it on the list.
All right.
I want to discuss
it. Add it to the list.
The one other thing, too, is we've had Christopher Nolan here who's had nothing but hit after hit after hit.
Yes.
And
yes. There's no
And Zach has had pretty good success, too. Even though these both guys have only have a very short filmography, they've really not had a big career killer in there. Yet.
Watchmen did wasn't not help his career.
Watchmen did better than Scott Pilgrim did, though. It wasn't as big a flop.
No, Scott Pilgrim flopped hard.
Oh, it flopped hard. That doesn't mean it isn't a great movie, tell me.
I'm not saying that.
But
I'm saying it was marketed horribly.
That's fair.
Yes, but still, he has two other films in the works, so he's still getting a lot. He still has enough.
Wait, are we talking Zack Snyder or are we talking Christopher Nolan?
Zack Snyder.
Zack Snyder.
Okay, all right, yeah.
I mean,
he's Zack Snyder has proven to me that he's got the balls to do the material right. So, like, if they picked him to do the Dark Tower adaptation, which they didn't, I would be okay with it. I would be excited about it. But instead, there's some other directors doing it who I'm not excited about. Because I don't want them to ruin my stuff.
Who is that? Ron Howard.
Ron Howard's not doing Dark Tower.
Yes, he is.
Bull.
Now, I find hard to believe.
I'd remember if it was Ron Howard.
They just announced it like 3 days ago.
I know. I would remember if it was Ron Howard.
It was Ron Howard.
Look, it's not like we have the interwebs here.
Howard.
Dark Tower in my pants.
Bam, 6 days ago, right here, Ron Howard and Akiva Goldsman's Dark Tower adaptation, September 9th, 2010.
God damn it. Ron Howard sucks, though.
You know what? They're doing it as three theatrical
movies
and a television series to
write.
That's not gonna work. Well, actually, that might work.
Television. I'm more convinced that epic novel should go to television series.
Oh my god! It's already got an IMDb listing.
Yeah, it's had an IMDb listing for a while. They just updated it to Ron Howard.
I've got chills. We're talking about Dark Tower. Oh, man. Anyway. Yeah, well, okay, you know what? That's a great example. Ron Howard, I've seen a bunch of movies he's done. You know what the best thing he's ever done was? Voiceovers on Arrested Development. I said it.
He's a better actor than director.
Mm. Oh, no, no disagreements. I think he's a crack.
He did a great job in Apollo 13.
He did a great job on Apollo 13, but it's very...
It was hard to screw up Apollo 13.
Great.
Ron Howard's directorial style is not to push an envelope, though, also.
No.
He shoots right for the main... He shoots for mediocrity.
Yep.
If he can hit the least common denominator and shoot right in the middle of mediocrity.
Yeah, exactly. He is
a commercial director.
This is my point. Not Christopher Nolan, who pushed the envelope.
And you have
pushed the envelope.
Yes. And it rolled the dice and it came up big.
Yeah.
So did Avatar. So did Cameron's Avatar.
I can appreciate the fact that these movies are successes because, and Cameron went out on a limb too.
Yeah.
Cameron's a great director. I mean, come on. I think we don't need to talk about his filmography.
No, not at all.
He's got plenty of hits to back up his worth as a director.
Yeah.
But, Ron Howard, those movies, the Da Vinci Code movies, average. At best.
Yeah.
Well, hold on. The Da Vinci Code novels were average at best.
Right.
Right. And exactly. That's my
point. Adaptation story. He took source material that was mediocre. And modified it. But he did change the source. He did change from the source material and watered it down even more.
Yeah, he kept it average. Zack Snyder could have done the same thing with Watchmen to make it easier to take. Christopher Nolan could have done the same thing with the Batman movie. I mean, look at the Batman movies we've had thus far.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, the bar was set pretty goddamn low.
Right, right. After the last one, it was about it.
And any series that goes into three or four movies, you start pushing the bar lower and lower. The thing was the first two Batman movies were great.
Yeah, the
Tim
Burton
they were at the time. After that, they fell off quick.
Well, that's when they started changing the lead actors. They started changing directors, and they started changing the entire style of the film.
Three and four were dreadful. Look, this made it back against money.
No, it didn't.
Yeah, worldwide, 185, Chief.
It still didn't make back its money because you have to get about 60% over. You have to get.
It says the budget's $130 million here.
Production budget is $130 million, but. Box office, some of that still goes to the theaters. The box office total, some of it still goes to the theaters.
Oh, okay.
So, especially if a movie stays in the theater for longer. The opening weekend stuff, the opening like weekend or two, is where the studio makes most of their money. If it goes past that, it all goes to the theater. So you're normally talking about 60% of whatever it takes can be figured for what the studio takes, what the studio actually takes.
Mm.
Watchmen. The fact is, Watchmen's profitable once it hits.
Okay, it's profitable.
The secondary market,
but it
once
was
it
not
hits
a
secondary
success.
Market. It is not a box office success.
It's a financial success.
It's a financial success once it gets to the
in
secondary
the strictest
market.
Terms.
Most you'd be hard pressed to find a movie that is not a financial success once it hits a secondary market.
Yeah, yeah.
DVDs, television, royalties, all that good stuff.
It's no Inception. It's no Dark Knight.
No.
Critical success.
Those make their bank up front.
Yep.
Everything else after that is just gravy.
Yep.
Scott Pilgrim, Watchmen, Kick-Ass, those are going to be squeezing...
Yep. Scraping the barrel to get by.
Right. Actually, I think Kick-Ass may have actually...
Did it really?
Beat it.
That was a good movie.
It was a good movie.
That was a terribly marketed movie.
That was, yes, it was. I remember talking to Melina about that and telling her, it's not a comedy. Do not, yeah.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
It did.
Well, what did Scott Pilgrim do? The numbers, the domestic total gross for Kick-Ass is $48 million. The production budget was $30 million, which is surprisingly low for something that has Nick Cage in it.
Worldwide, $96 million, though. That's tripled its budget worldwide.
That's not bad. That is not bad. We got here.
Speaking of which, since we're talking about this, I did just get the domain
backseat box office.
Yeah.
So I may start recording episodes of that soon.
Oh yeah, that flopped hard.
Yeah. Worldwide total $41 million, production budget $60 million.
Man, that's rough.
Yeah.
That is rough.
But it's poorly marketed.
Poorly marketed.
And it's an unknown character.
Poorly marketed, unknown character,
and
it pushes the envelope.
Yes. Well, and you know, it doesn't help when you have lead actors in the movie coming out saying, "Yeah, you either get it or you don't."
Did Michael Cera say that?
It wasn't Michael Cera, it was somebody else. I'm not sure who.
That's funny.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't Michael Cera, because I imagine he's been around the biz long enough to know you don't say something like that. To challenge an audience by saying, you either get it or you don't, most of the people were like, fine, you don't get my money. They're just going to walk away from it.
Well, you're going to lose your mainstream audience, for sure.
If you don't have something that's not already a property that people can relate to,
yep.
People are just going to walk away.
Well, yeah. Scott Pilgrim was a successful manga before it was a movie. And in fact, the graphic novel just wound up slightly before the movie did.
Yep.
But people who have been reading that for several years kind of already knew what it was about.
Yeah.
But still, like, that's a very small audience.
Anyone who's ever read it saw the movie from looking at the box office stalls. I mean, it's...
Well, see, that's the problem when you take a property like...
in U.S., that's... You're talking Kevin Smith numbers there.
Well, that...
Realistically. But he makes movies for $8 to $10 million, so...
Yeah, but the one thing too, this is a problem when you've got a source material that is fairly narrow in its audience, and then you try to make it accessible to a wider audience. Now you can do, like you say, you can try to dumb it down or change it to make it more appealing, and you'll lose all your core fans.
Mm-hmm.
who will chew you up,
yep,
in the press. Or you can try to remain true to form and please the core audience and lose all your general appeal, and you'll still get bad-mouthed in the press.
Yeah, well,
so it's a no-win situation.
That's what The Last Airbender faced.
The thing is, being bad-mouthed by a niche genre,
mm-hmm,
doesn't lose you fans.
Mm-hmm. Holy crap, look at those numbers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Domestic total, $131 million. Production budget was $150 million, but the worldwide gross was $281 million.
So, it's a huge success overseas. Success.
Yeah.
It made its money back.
Wow.
And then some.
And then some.
It almost doubled.
And there's no DVD yet. There's a ton of toy tie-ins.
Because
We've got some of them. We've got the DS game. We've got... Holden just got some toy that you, like... make the motions and across the rooms things blow up or something. I don't know.
Well, this was Airbender's problem. Airbender had one of two choices. It can either stick to the source material or dumb it down. And instead of picking one, it tried to walk this middle ground, and that's why it failed.
Yeah.
If Shyamalan had picked one of those two things, either go full out accessible and get everybody into this story and make it just an M. Night movie, it would have been fine. Conversely, if he'd also gone balls to the wall, Katara needs loopies, she needs to be crazy, she needs to be so full of hope that she's tear-bending, that, like, that was the way I wish he would have gone with it. However, that's not what he elected to do, and he paid the price for it.
Potentially, I can almost see, if he listens to the fans at all, if he listens
He'll
to
change
people
it.
Who saw the movie at all, I'm hoping... I hope they make book two.
Yeah, me too. Tough.
I hope that he's the director, and I hope that he listens to all of this.
Yes.
Because I think they still have an opportunity
to rescue the franchise.
To do something very cool with the franchise by setting the bar so ridiculously low with this first movie. Anything after this is going to be compared.
Water is the worst season.
True. That is true.
Because the show gets progressively better. If that's what happens with the movies, I'm fine with that. Toph's not in season one. Whatever. Okay. We all get to the Northern Water Tribe, we wave our hands at the sea, and then let's move on to Toph. That's really where we're all going, right?
I'm with you.
Toph and Azula.
Okay. So getting back to
Nolan, Nolan and Zach.
Our two guys. You have... We've talked a lot more about Snyder than Nolan. We've talked about Nolan's other movies other than...
Dark Knight
and Batman Begins, which was kind of
the comparators there. So Batman Begins and Dark Knight, he took a story which everybody knows. Everybody knows the goddamn Batman story because they've done it four times.
Right. And he actually took some popular some versions of the story that exist. He didn't completely make up the stories that he used. You know, he didn't come up with any new crazy characters. The characters that he used already all existed. The Scarecrow, Ra's al Ghul, Joker. You know, they're all there.
Yeah, we already know them.
The thing was, is he made a really interesting choice in Batman Begins in not having Joker be the first villain.
Yeah, that was great. And actually, starting with Ra's al Ghul was fantastic.
When it was announced that Ra's al Ghul was going to be the first villain, I was like, oh, really? That's kind of an odd choice.
Ra's al Ghul and the Scarecrow. But
there's not so much canon surrounding him. There was a lot less Scarecrow.
When the announcement came out, they didn't say anything about Scarecrow. It was still... The big bad is going to be Ra's al Ghul.
Which was cool.
It's cool. And what's cool about
it... And it was goddamn Qui-Gon Jinn.
Well, and what's really cool about it is Ra's al Ghul is far enough out of the mainstream that when my mom goes to see the Batman movie, she's not going to know that Ra's al Ghul's a bad guy. You know? So you're introduced to a character who, by all intents and purposes, is a mentor. It's somebody that he's looking up to. It's somebody that he's...
To be fair, his name does have ghoul in it.
Yeah, but...
Z's and ghouls, man. You can never trust those characters.
That's true. And he has...
Both.
But to be fair, for what they presented in the film, it's an unknown character to the mainstream.
Right. Yeah. And so, to a lot of fans, too.
That's true.
Was to me.
Casual fans don't know of Ra's al Ghul.
I didn't. I mean, because he wasn't in the first four movies.
There you go. So I thought it was a cool choice because it was a way that you could kind of pull the rug out from under most of the audience. The fans who knew Ra's al Ghul was a bad guy got a little excited when he shows up as part of the origin because you know where it's going.
Yep.
So even for them, you're tweaking them quite a bit.
Yeah. So I'm totally in. I mean,
that was a very good writer director choice was to use enough familiar material to satisfy your core audience and still introduce enough new elements to keep them interested.
One of the things that there was a couple things I really liked stylistically because we've talked about Snyder's style,
right?
Stylistically, Nolan made a couple of really cool choices. One, we full on committed that Batman is a ninja, and
fine.
Yeah, perfect. That makes sense.
Yeah. We've been dancing around it for years. Let's just get it on the table and let's just move on.
Batman's a ninja. Let's move on. I really like the style of the quick action, the quick, really close action in the fights in the dark where he's being Batman.
Yeah.
Because, let's face it, we're supposed to get the feeling of being put off, being off-center, being confused about what's going on.
It's the goddamn Batman.
Those scenes are also kind of shot from the perspective of the bad guys.
Yeah.
So they don't know what's going on. You know, we see quick flashes in the
dark.
He's
a ninja. Yeah, this is how ninjas fight. Yeah, exactly. It was great.
So stylistically, that worked.
I think we're getting close to the most compelling decision that Christopher Nolan ever made, and it was glaring in people's faces, and I loved it because nobody ever talks about it. Well, it's less talked about.
I don't know if it's the same one I'm going to talk about, but
the one that
I like is the fact that everything they did with the Scarecrow was full on horror movie trope.
Yes,
and I loved that because it really gave you a feeling of being in a nightmare. When you saw Batman from that one guy's perspective and he looked down,
you see like, the glowing eyes. He looked like David Lopan. Yes,
he looked terrifying, and it was like this is awesome because this is what we should feel as somebody looking at Batman who is under the influence of the Scarecrow.
Yeah, I was in for that.
That was fantastic. I loved that.
I was totally in for that. So, I mean, everything about Batman Begins I dug.
Yeah.
It was great. Now we get to The Dark Knight. The best decision Christopher Nolan made, and this is the glaring FU to the entire comic book community. He removed Batman from the title.
Yeah.
This isn't a Batman movie. Booyah! It's a Batman movie that is so accessible, he doesn't even need Batman in the title!
That was great.
Brilliant! Ah! If you say Maggie Gyllenhaal, I will shoot you. I don't have a problem with Maggie Gyllenhaal. I don't think that she's all that hot, but...
I do.
She's no Jennifer Connelly, Tony Mast.
You are right about that.
Jennifer Connelly is Batgirl. Oh,
Jennifer
yeah.
Jennifer Connelly and Maggie Gyllenhaal. But, let's put it this way.
It's
they're up there.
Yeah. Like, average is down here. Yes. Like, there's a disparity, but it's a, like, there's a disparity between 192, so... Yes.
That's true.
God damn, that was the best thing I think he did with Dark Knight, because it's like, oh, this is the first Batman movie that doesn't have Batman in the title. Yeah, that's the point. That's the freaking point.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is the perfect summary of his directorial career.
And I'm trying to think, now that you mention it, I'm trying to think of any movie, any superhero movie that's ever done that. And I can't think of one.
Well, there hasn't been any that have such a long running... I mean, Superman... But the Superman titles are all Superman something.
They also have Superman in the title.
Batman doesn't have more movies, but it's a longer...
Rumor has it the next one might not. Because they're talking about...
please tell me to do it.
Reboot. Last in the Krypton.
I can deal with that.
As being the title. And Christopher Nolan's doing it. Christopher Nolan's producing it.
Oh, I got a warm, funny feeling in my testicles.
I know.
It could be cancer.
It could be, but hey, that's a risk I'm willing to take.
As long as it doesn't take me before it comes out. What about Zardoz?
That was not really a comic book based movie at all.
I wasn't being serious.
No, well, mentioning First Blood, but I'm talking about superhero. Yeah, because the original First Blood doesn't have Rambo's name in the title. Mm-hmm. But First Blood was
we
a
only
novel.
Introduced the character.
Well, it was a novel too.
Yeah.
It was a novel named called First Blood. So
that could have been a movie about menstruation. I mean,
or vampires,
or vampires, both. Or both. Period. Where did you think you were going to branch this discussion out into, Tony?
Just looking at some of the other licensed properties that have been made into movies. You know, we've got the Spider-Man movies. You get the whole range of comic book movies that have been made. But you've also got things like...
Spider-Man were very average.
Well, I don't know. The Sam Raimi directed one was pretty awesome.
That number one?
They were all directed by Sam Raimi. All three of them.
Okay. My mistake.
Number one was awesome. Number two fell into the sequel tropes, and then number three went into a weird place.
Number three.
Fell into the third, the trio weird place.
It fell into the trio weird place. It also fell into the weird place of having a lot of studio influence.
Oh.
Because...
Is that what happened?
Yeah. Well, the gist of it was it was supposed to be a Spider-Man Sandman movie with kind of the wrapping up of the Harry storyline.
Uh-huh.
But then they're like, oh, we need Venom in this one.
Oh, yeah. That's...
And they're like, he's like, yeah, Venom's going to be part of it. He's going to get the black costume. So Venom's going to be, no, we need Venom, not the black costume. He's like, no, we're just going to introduce the black costume in this movie. We'll do Venom. No, we need Venom now.
We can make another
movie. Too many stories going on.
The problem was, and if you kind of, you know, if you look at the movie, because I've had the misfortune of having a son who was 5 or 6 when he was really heavily into watching that DVD, so we watched it
a lot
every day. I got to see the movie a lot, and you kind of can't help but start picking it apart. There are actually some really good parts of that movie. Everything with the Sandman, basically until they really start showing how the black costume affects Peter, everything up to that point is really solid. It's really good. It's after that everything just falls apart real quick. Because, like, the... And like the, especially all the effects surrounding Sandman are really well done. They put a lot of production into those. The scene... there's a scene that's just heartbreaking when he first turns into the Sandman and he's grasping for that pendant of his daughter's in the sand and he keeps collapsing and falling into sand and he's trying to pick it up and he can't. It's heartbreaking. It's really cool to watch. Then after that, it all just kind of goes into that weird place that... He's Spidey dancing, and now, granted, that's all from the comic book. That's not anything they made up. But
that's still
there's choices that you can make.
There's good choices and bad choices.
When you're
choices.
Adapting material, and that was a bad choice, was to adapt that so literally.
Zack Snyder would have put it in.
He would have.
He would have put it in, but he would have made it cool.
Maybe.
Spears into Persians, Tony.
So what was
Christopher Nolan
the
thinking
arms
about?
Off of that dude in the prison though?
What?
Because I don't remember that being in Watchmen.
What are you talking about?
Rorschach.
It was in the comic.
It was?
No, it wasn't. I don't remember it being there.
Where he cut the arms off of the dude in the
yeah.
Was it?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, he did. Excuse me, right, when he was reaching through the bars.
When he reached through the bars, that's how he could get it, because there's three guys.
No, he didn't cut his arms off. He broke his thumbs and tied them together, and he was stuck there.
He got the guy stuck so that the guys on the outside cut through him to get to the door.
No, they didn't do that. They cut his throat first, then they cut through they torched through the bars and him. I'll give you the comic. You can...
Either way,
refresh.
They cut through the guy at some point.
Right.
Okay. I thought that was a weird choice because it was a choice that I thought was odd if they were going to try and make any money off this movie. Because there was a couple of scenes they could have changed and made this a PG-13 movie. And one of the biggest things...
He didn't want to make
it. I know he didn't want to make a PG-13 movie.
Hey, Jeff.
But if they wanted to make money on this movie... It should have been a PG-13 movie. That's the problem with it. They cut out a huge audience for this movie.
No disagreement.
13 to 16-year-old boys? Are you kidding me? Just not giving them access to see it in a theater without getting an adult? That's a failure. That's a business failure.
No disagreements. This is why I like his balls. I like his balls. I like the extremes.
Do you like cupping them or rolling them around?
I like touching them with my balls. Like I like the extremes in directing. You're either going to go fully balls in, or you're going to rewrite it to make it awesome. And I think that Nolan does one and Snyder does the other.
Which one's better, in your opinion?
Ooh, Tony.
Making you stick to something.
No, it's easy. Snyder's better.
You think so?
Yeah.
I think Nolan's better.
I think that in the realm, if you accept that movies are art, and if they are a manifestation, if you accept that movies are art, and if that art is based off source material art, then you cannot, in good conscience, create art based off other art based off a business decision.
You're either an artist or you're a businessman, but not both.
Yes. And I think that if your source material is art, you can't... Making business decisions based off that is a sellout.
Okay, I can see that. But I can also see making your art accessible to the masses. And I think that is a mistake that Zack Snyder makes, where Christopher Nolan is making his art more accessible to the masses... And therefore making the source material more accessible to people who might not have been accessible to previously.
Don't get me wrong. You told me I had to pick one, so I picked one.
That's fine.
However,
I'm throwing
I have
on the
immense
table.
Respect for Christopher Nolan because he does the other side of it well.
Yes.
I don't feel when I watch his movies and I'm watching something like when I watch Dark Knight, I don't feel that he's sold out. because he's taken.
Do you think that Nolan is a sellout?
No, because he changes it in a way that adds value to it.
Okay.
If he just made it more accessible by making it more generic and more crap, I'd be upset because I'd feel. Last Airbender. I was upset because it had clearly sold out.
I don't think it clearly sold out. I think it was clearly poorly made.
It was an attempt to sell out. It was a bad attempt to sell out. It was a poor attempt at selling out.
Anytime you're taking something and turning it into something to try and make more money off of it, you're selling out on it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can make that argument. If you're talking about pure art, you're saying you're taking something. You're taking something. I mean, looking at it, if you're going to take it from pure art's sake, look at Alan Moore, who's basically said, by taking this out of the medium that it was originally created for, was originally intended for, you are fundamentally changing this in such a way that is no longer
identified. Right,
it's no longer true to its original source material, and therefore it is shit.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I mean, and that's Alan Moore's opinion of it.
Without having
seen it.
Alan
Moore is dead wrong.
On one hand, I can agree with what he's saying. If I write a book and then you make a movie. Well, you haven't made the movie of my book. You've made a movie inspired by my book.
Right.
My book is the work. It's not the same work.
No.
I understand.
And my take on it is, if you're going to just literally translate something into another medium, you're not creating art.
Ooh.
I disagree. I have more artistic integrity for Nolan because he is taking
He's adapting.
He's truly adapting. He's taking something and putting his artistic spin on something that has existed before.
I can agree.
Where Snyder is
a workman.
He's
hired gun. He's a pure director. He does not try to interpret. Well, he's not taking the source material and applying his spin on it. He's taking the screenwriter's interpretation of it, and I'm making a movie.
I will give you that for Watchmen. I cannot, in good conscience, give you that for 300. 300 was a visual experience, and while it can be argued that the graphic novel was also a visual experience, adapting the comic experience to the screen is no small feat at all.
No, it's not.
That man was a godsend. Because that 300, whether or not you liked the story, whether you liked it, that was a beautiful movie.
Yes.
That movie was gorgeous. And it was
300? Oh, yeah.
I think that movie, and I'll go on record as saying this, I think that movie is prettier and has better graphics and provides a better visual experience than Avatar.
I don't know.
I also don't like light blue.
I've seen it once.
I would have to agree with you on that because I can watch 300 again and again and get something out of it each time. I don't think I can ever watch Last Airbender and get something out of it.
Not Last Airbender, Avatar.
Okay, Avatar.
Cameron's
okay,
the Avatar. Anime.
Oh, that Avatar. Okay, excuse me. Yeah.
I don't... Maybe my problem is that I haven't... Like, there's no graphic novel of Avatar, so I don't have, like, an experience... Because I've read the 300 graphic novel,
right,
and then I've seen the movie, and the movie is stunning. Like Avatar is also stunning, but in a different way. Like it's less.
I get less out of it.
I don't know.
I think Avatar is more immersive.
Mm.
I felt seeing it in 3D. How was it intended?
Right.
I mean that's the intended way of seeing Avatar. I think that becomes a different experience, and they're both visually stunning, highly stylized,
yeah,
and in many ways equal because the substance-wise, they're both pretty light on substance, you know.
No disagreements. Although I think 300 is a little more honest about what it is in that regard. It is preachy, yes, but less preachy.
Right.
And the plot is less recycled.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about, you know, it's kind of like the Jennifer Connelly.
Yes.
Maggie Gyllenhaal argument.
Oh, yeah. They're both beautiful movies.
They're both very beautiful. They're both stylized. They're both light on substance.
And I don't know. I don't. I don't think that I'm objective enough to tell you that I think that I get a better experience out of 300 because I enjoy the story and presentation more. I think this
that's fine.
I think it's a completely subjective argument.
I think that's honest.
I think it's a completely subjective argument.
What you take from a story and what you're getting from a story is going to inform your opinion on that. And that's... I don't have a problem you saying that.
No disagreements. I don't disagree with you not having a problem with me saying that.
No, and, you know, there was a couple of other movies that I thought of because I have seen the source material and seen the movie. I know probably nobody here. I mean, you've seen the movie Forrest Gump?
Yeah.
You haven't read the source material, no. I'm assuming. Don't waste your time.
I didn't plan on it.
It's pretty awful.
Here's the one that we can talk about. The Harry Potter movies.
Yes, that's a good one. And I think it's a good choice because they've made both. They've done both. You had Christopher Columbus making the very literal translations of the book.
Which worked well for the early ones.
Almost to a fault. I would say the first Harry Potter movie is a little hard to watch.
It's hard to watch, but you know what? It's the only way it could have been done.
No, it's not the only way it could have been done. It's the only way it could have been done if they wanted to make six or seven more movies of the series. It had to be that true to the source material.
Yeah, to set the story.
To set up the story, to get all the
characters introduced.
Yeah, and to get the world. Well, to get the fans bought in. I mean, the fact is, the difference is the number of people who had read and consumed the media of Harry Potter was staggering.
Yep.
When it got to that point. I mean, to the point where you're talking...
just about everyone in the English-speaking world.
At least had some familiarity with it. Even if they had not read it, there was...
they at least knew of it.
Right. And there are people that, I mean, that where they know of Superman, Spider-Man, Batman, have never picked up a comic book.
Yeah.
Not to the same level as people have
with Harry Potter.
Really experienced Harry Potter by reading the original source material.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that says a lot right there too, because you've got a much broader fan base that you have to impress with what you're doing.
Yeah.
Than trying to make it for mainstream, because you're getting to a point where your fan base is the mainstream.
Which makes Harry Potter such an interesting case study because they've run the gamut of that.
Yeah, and I mean, look at Half-Life.
Prisoner of Azkaban was widely regarded as the worst one. Which, why? Well, I don't understand at all. That's the best one.
At this point, I think, I want to say that, at least by the fans, because you're also talking about, probably about three or four books in, the number of people that have read the books starts dropping off severely.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I know a lot of people that have read the first book. The first two books. Mm-hmm. And after that, they didn't pick them up because they're pretty poorly written. The books get a lot better.
I started with Prisoner of Azkaban. Yeah. Although I would have finished it regardless.
I read the first one. I was like, oh, why is this so popular? And I read the second one. I was like, oh, this is not good.
And I just
kept muscling through them.
And Sirius Black shows up, and he's a mass murderer, and you're like, all right, I'm in now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they got better.
Well, keep in mind, Harry Potter was turned down by every major publisher, and Scholastic was the absolute last choice.
And there's a good reason for it. I mean,
Scholastic was the bottom of the barrel as far as publishers went. Now, they just happened to use their huge marketing muscle to get this thing out to every freaking school in the country, and they created the market.
We get those little flyers from both Aaron's preschool and Holden's grade school. I mean,
oh, those like book order things. Mm-hmm. Those things were cool.
Yep,
I loved those things.
And now they send like four of them at a time.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, you skipped 3, 4, and 5, Jeff? Come on, buddy. What are you doing to me? 3, 4, and 5 is where the heart of the story is.
Yeah.
And that is a fact.
And there's some of the longest ones, too.
Yeah. So, and I think it's... But what I was going to say is they made some really interesting choices with the sixth movie.
Because, I mean, that one is widely regarded by fans as awful.
Yeah. Do you hear me scoffing over
here? Yeah, oh, I know. And I understand why. But, and I contend that this was Harry Potter the Romantic Comedy.
Well, I'm fine
looking,
with
it. And looking at it as a romantic comedy, I think it succeeded. As a film, as a romantic comedy, I think it worked.
The worst
the problem. The problem is it's supposed to be a mystery, not a romantic
comedy. It's supposed to be mystery horror.
Yeah.
I mean, because one of the central themes of the book is, like, paranoia. Voldemort is out killing people. No one believes me. The state is against me, and they're calling me a goddamn... No, that's not six. That's five.
It's five. No, six is all about who is the Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah, six is all about who is the Half-Blood Prince, and the state is still keeping people in the dark about the whole thing.
Right. And then
Dumbledore's the crazy black hand.
And the final choice, which side are you on?
Well, yeah.
I was on Team Snape.
I was on Team Snape from book one. It was obvious. It was obvious from book one. It was so foreshadowed from book one. It was ridiculous. And it was, I mean, it was one of those, yes, I know this is written for 12-year-olds, so they won't get how backhandedly subtle you are being about Snape is really a good guy. But, you know.
I touch my balls to Alan Rickman's balls. I think it is. God damn, I can't wait for that seventh movie to come out. Very shortly.
I saw a
trailer for it.
Commercial for it tonight.
Oh, commercial.
Television commercial.
Yes. Well, they need to get that movie out quick. The Harry Potter buzz is slouching away.
November and June, I think.
Oh, my birthday. Happy birthday, me.
Whatever happens on these last two films, they better go all out on them.
Yeah, Zack Snyder better direct them. And balls to the wall, Mrs. Weasley.
Just as long as those scenes with Mrs. Weasley and...
First off, you can see in the trailer.
Yeah, I know.
In the trailer, there is the part where they're at the Battle of Hogwarts at the end, and Hermione is trying to hold Ron back, and that's because George just died. That is what happens there. Yeah. And it's like, oh, shit. Because you know what happens next. Mrs. Weasley goes fucking ape shit.
All I got to say is the Neville reveal had better be as epic as it was in the book.
It won't be.
It won't be, and that's going to be a
shame. It won't be, yeah, because Neville's the kind of best character in the whole goddamn series.
But you know what's cool is looking at the actor that played Neville, he was a short, fat, dumpy little kid, and he just turned out to be kind of a stud.
Yeah, have you seen the British tabloids with him?
No.
Like, he goes out club, and, like, they got this picture of him. He's got, like, this half-goatee thing. He's got two hot chicks on his arms. It's like, yes, Neville on bottom, yes!
That is Neville.
Put your seed in them.
He's the other boy who lives.
He's making up for lost
time.
He's
the boy who bangs.
Yeah. That's true.
He's getting back at all those years.
Yeah.
Hey, look at this, bitches.
Yeah. I'll show you my huge black wand.
That's all I got.
That's all I got, too.
I think we've beat the subject to death.
You know what? We have given our opinion. I don't think you've given your opinion on what stylistic choice, you know, between how Nolan did it and how Snyder did it. What appeals more to you? I don't even know if it's what's better or worse. What appeals to you more?
No, Harry Potter.
Neville Longbang.
Oh, man.
Ooh. Okay, I enjoy Nolan's approach to it.
Okay.
I mean, he's very satisfying. He knows his material. He delivers. It's fun to watch.
But
you have to be patient to wait for the payoff. Zach is all the way through. Bang, 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 bang. I mean, I went through all of Inception.
I was fisting, too.
I was going through all the way in Inception. It took a long time to get to the payoff. It was worth the wait.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to be patient and pay attention to what was going on. Now, Zach, he's gonna deliver all the way through the movie. And I kind of know what the payoff's going to be, too. But it's a roller coaster. It's not like reading a novel. I like both of those approaches. Zach is very workmanlike in his approach. You can see his commercial background there. It's a lot of subs. He sells the product up front and keeps selling the product all the way through. Nolan is the artist. He's going to you've got to be patient to get through. It's not a roller coaster. It's a drive to the country. Mm-hmm. But the drive to the country ends up at Disneyland.
That's fair. That is fair.
Yeah.
Again, the problem is with these two guys is they have real short filmographies. I mean, between the two of them, they've only made about four to five movies apiece. So it's really hard to get a gauge on them. It's not like you're looking at John Ford with, 100 movies to his credit. And chances are they're never...
Yeah, that's right. I was counting Nolan's.
Well, you got to count his early... His one early film, too.
The one that has... That I think is getting released in the U.S.
Right.
Soon. Because it wasn't released in the U.S. It was like a student film project or something.
Right. It was his it was called The Following. It was kind of it was done before the Memento. Memento was the second movie he ever made. He made the first one as a student film for $6,000 in over a year filming on weekends. But it grossed something like $30 million once it was released. But it hasn't had a really wide audience. But that's pretty damn good for a movie that was made on a telling.
I typed in Google using Google Instant. I typed in IMDb. It filled in IMDb Inception.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go ahead.
Part of that is from your search history, though.
Part of it is.
Yeah. I'm anxious to see what these guys are going to do in the future. It sounds like looking at their project list in the future, they got some really really great stuff.
Yeah,
and. It's really exciting to see how they're going to handle it.
That's right. He did.
Is that the one with Angelina Jolie?
Which one?
Insomnia?
No, it's with Al Pacino.
Robin Williams.
Robin Williams, yeah.
And Hilary Swank.
I think we might have talked about this one back in the Deuce days.
You guys might have. I haven't.
This was another movie that's actually a remake.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a Swedish... film?
Yeah, and it was completely rewritten by him, and it has a completely different plot line from the original the original movie.
Well, the Writers Guild still says that it's the Swedes, Nikolaj Frobenius and Erik
Skjoldberg.
The SKJ is where I'm guessing the
Skjoldberg.
Where I'm guessing the Swedish influence comes in. Yeah, that movie was another one where it kind of gets in your head because he really plays around with the idea of having insomnia, and you're in like Alaska. So they're doing a murder investigation. He's like, oh, I need to go get a cheeseburger. Okay, go get a cheeseburger because it's bright. And they're like, it's 3 a.m. Like, oh, yeah, I guess I need to be sleeping now.
Well, I'm looking forward to Zach's next movie after Legends of the Guardians, Sucker Punch. Looking at the trailer for that and looks... Interesting.
I haven't seen the trailer for what's the premise like?
The basic story is this young girl is in a mental institution put there by her quote-unquote wicked stepfather, and in 5 days she's going to be lobotomized, so she's got to devise an escape plan to get out of here.
Oh, I did hear about that. It's got kind of a like a Neo One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Well, it's kind of like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest meets The Matrix. At least that's the way the trailer seems to do it. Now, this is a completely original piece of work. It has no previous source material on it. I'm anxious to see how it's going to work.
I'm curious to see how he handles the original
stuff. I am.
Stuff.
I'm anxious to see what they've all, how these guys are going to do in the future when they start doing more original stuff.
Has he done anything with original stuff?
No, he hasn't.
Yeah, okay, well, because he had...
He's all been doing other people's stuff.
Right. Yeah, that'll be interesting to see then.
I mean, in the future, these guys are going to be some major names. If they can continue their level of work.
I think it's fair to say that Nolan is a major name at this point.
Well, let's put it this way. He's 5 movies does not make a career.
No, but when you have 5 movies that bank this much,
yeah, well,
you're doing well.
I agree. You're a reliable property in Hollywood.
Yeah,
people are going to line up are going to come to you to do their stuff.
Well, I mean, that's why. That's kind of why, you know, when he kind of offhandedly mentioned to Warner that, yeah, I've got some ideas for what would be cool for the new Superman, for the next Superman movie. They're like, you're the producer.
Yeah, you're on it. Like, you're on it. Green lighted. Whatever you want, son.
That's yeah. I mean, he's done so well with the Batman property, and I mean, the cool thing is yes, he's changed it. Yes, he's modified it. Yes, he's taken existing material and done something new with it, but he's done it very lovingly. He's done it with an eye to the source material. He has bothered to learn. If he wasn't already a comic book fan before, if he didn't already know the material before, he bothered to learn.
Right. But the one thing I'd like to see with Nolan is how he would work when he's not the writer, when he's just purely the director, taking somebody else's screenplay and interpreting it to film. I'd like to see how that would work.
Yeah.
In other words, be a pure director.
He runs the danger of getting too far inside his own head.
Well, his last bunch of movies, they've always been written and directed by. So that means he's had pretty much total control of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens when you don't have total control? The studio gives you a spec script, and says, make this movie. No changes. Or no more than necessary. Or you cannot have too many rewrites.
See, the problem is, he'll have to... I think the way that'll happen is if he fails.
Mm.
I don't see... At this point...
But how would you characterize a Christopher Nolan failure?
The Prestige. That movie was terrible.
I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Yeah.
How did it do in the box office?
I don't know. You got the magic box. By that, I mean vagina.
You're just jealous.
But I'll look at it this way. Both of these directors have had very, very charmed lives so far.
But the thing is, as long as Nolan keeps making the kind of money he's made in his last two movies, the studio is going to let him do whatever he wants.
Right.
I mean, he's...
Nothing succeeds like success.
Yes.
And as long as you're making box office and you're not blowing the studio's money...
I don't know how this movie made money. It was terrible. It didn't make much. Watchmen made more money.
Yeah, but look at the budget. $40 million.
But you have the difference of the budget. It's a matter of percentages at that point too. You can't just take a look at the
this
bottom
is a
line
matter
numbers.
Of shaping feces into a movie.
And for $40 million and make $100 million on worldwide, that's not bad. I mean, commercially that's a success. Critically, it's criticism is what drives the movie business.
Criticism drives this podcast.
That too.
Criticism and analysis.
Deep
analysis.
And
occasionally, bourbon.
Bourbon.
And not as often as it used to, Bud Light.
I haven't drank on the show in almost a year.
It's been a while.
Yes,
you're slacking. It may actually have been more than a year.
You're slacking off.
I think it's been more than a year.
People are beginning to wonder, what happened to the old Adam? Is that a replacement, Adam?
He got old.
Oh, yeah.
75%.
75% on Rotten Tomato.
Full of twists and turns, The Prestige is a dazzling period piece that never stops challenging the audience.
Oh, yeah, the steampunk part of the world is going to love this movie.
Oh, I can't stand steampunk.
Yeah, me neither. Jeez.
Yeah, but hey, it's a genre that does quite well.
Yeah. It's not a genre. Steampunk is not a genre. Pulp action is a genre. Steampunk is fashion.
Yeah, but that's exactly right there. Steampunk is a fashion action. That does very well. Because it has goggles and lights in weird places.
Ugh.
I'm leaving now.
Yep.
No, that's good.
All right, looks like we're done here.
We haven't announced it yet. Upcoming, in some order. Let's see. And Daryl's added a couple. We've got... The Fly, Big Fish, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, Forbidden Planet, Retro. Is that, I guess you mean by the original?
Yeah, well, there's never been a remake.
Okay. And then Ice Station Zebra.
Interesting.
Because we talked about something else while we were actually recording, and I don't remember now what that was. Anyway.
Not The Prestige.
All right. That's it.
Later,
good night.
Yep.
See you next week.